Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Wednesday Conversation. I'm Bethany Gilbert, and I'm here with Pastor Bob Thune of Coram Deo Church. Every Wednesday, we sit down to talk about how the gospel of Jesus Christ connects to the questions and issues of everyday life. And today, we're talking about the book on racism we should all be reading. And we're joined again by Coram Deo elder and sociologist, Kevin Easta.
Welcome again, Kevin.
Thank you, Bob.
I got to set up a number of things here. Last time we did this podcast, you had recommended, hey, here's a really good book. And I said, hey, I'll read it if you'll join me on the podcast and talk about it. So here we are. The problem is Bethany and Travis haven't read it, and they're also in the room. And so now I feel like we're having a conversation about a book that half of us have read, and I feel like that's lame. So
if we have any questions, we'll just ask them.
Part of the problem here is I read books fast, and you know, I didn't feel good saying, hey, would you please read this by 3 days from now so that we can talk about it? Also, we have some new gadgets, and one of the benefits of the new gadgets for the podcast is we have some sound effects now. How about that? Thank you, audience. Thanks for your applause. I love that. And then Travis, do we have like, if Kevin makes a really lame point, do it?
Love it.
Yeah, love there
it.
We go.
Love
there
it.
We go. So we got some things we'll probably play with along the podcast here, just having some fun. We're upping our game here with sound effects, audience tracks, you know, having fun. The book we want to talk about, the book on racism that I'm convinced we should all be reading. And here's what happened. I picked up this book and realized this book was written in 2006, and I have never heard of it until right now, until you a few weeks ago, Kevin, recommended it to me. And I thought, man, this book is super helpful. And in fact, it adds nuance to these conversations that I feel like I've been looking for, some books that add some nuance and bring some clarity to some really fuzzy aspects of our conversation about race. Well, George Yancey did it 14 years ago, and I just didn't find the book until now. The book's title is Beyond Racial Gridlock. And the author is George Yancey. George Yancey is a sociologist like Kevin. George Yancey works at Baylor University right now. I think he's only been there for a year or two. He was at North Texas for a long time. And his specialty is in race-related issues. So he started out studying interracial relationships and marriages, and then he did a big project in the early 2000s examining multiracial churches. And so he's writing as a Christian, as an African-American, and as a sociologist. And I think he brings a really profound perspective because of all of those aspects.
That's a really unique combination. You don't hear that perspective a lot, and you can tell that those different angles that he's coming from really allow him to speak in ways that others could not. And actually, it's a comfort too. Like it's hard for two white guys to sit here and talk about this conversation. It's nice that we're reading a book from an African American's perspective, and I think we can have a bit more courage to speak about those things because of that.
Yeah. Here's what I like about what Yancey is doing right from the outset. He's saying, hey, look, I'm writing self-consciously as a Christian, and I want to move us toward a specifically and distinctly Christian approach to the problem of racism. And he says right in the introduction, the problem with most of the answers being proposed is that they're secular answers. And so it's not that they're wrong. They're just incomplete. Mm-hmm. They don't get us all the way where we need to go. And so the way he frames out this book is, I want to show you what I think is wrong with the answers that are being proposed. And then I want to try to start a conversation about a distinctly Christian approach. And Kevin, what I like about this is he writes with a certain kind of humility. He's basically saying, I want to start a conversation. I'm not even sure I've done all the work that needs to be done here, but let me just try to get us thinking and talking in a different way.
Yeah. So he's using the tools of his training and his unique perspective because of who he is in society and being part of multiracial churches, for example, being part of the academy, knowing all these different perspectives and being involved in these conversations. He's bringing those tools and that expertise to bear and then saying, okay, this is where I see these things as incomplete. And here is a gospel perspective. Here is a piece of the biblical narrative that seems to be missing. That's part of the incompleteness of these secular approaches to dealing to race relations. Here's one piece that seems to be missing. But then at the end, he's very open. Like, this is just part of this is just one attempt to craft a biblical approach to race relations. And is definitely open to more conversations. I think it's good that we're talking about it.
His contention is, he says, my reading of secular and Christian literature on issues of race has not uncovered any unique stance on the part of the Christian church. So it's not just that he feels the secular models are inadequate. He says, I don't think the church has spoken with a distinctly prophetic voice in this place. He says, basically, as he surveys, he's going to tell us about four basic solutions that have been proposed to racism. And he says, basically, Christians have just adopted one of these four and kind of slap some Bible verses on it. But the problem is none of them is coming from a distinctly Christian paradigm. And all for those of you who like want to know what his cards are up front, here's what he says at the very end of the introduction. I believe that a true Christian solution must take our sin nature into account. To this end, I will introduce the mutual responsibility model and will elaborate on it throughout the rest of the book. So what he's saying is, hey, look, if we're going to have a Christian solution to racism, we got to talk about the problem of sin and the pervasiveness of sin. And that's what's not getting dealt with in all four of these other paradigms that are being proposed. And I want to say, how do we propose a solution to racism that takes seriously the pervasiveness and the reality of sin?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's a great critique. And I think it applies to this situation, but it applies, I think, for Christians. And we have a tendency to just kind of get co-opted into other secular movements, whatever it is, whether it's race related, or it's political parties, whatever it is. And I think there's a good warning here that, okay, in all of those situations, we want to be able to step back and say, okay, what's good here that you know, what's helpful, in what ways is this incomplete, and craft the biblical narrative of how we should be addressing the topic. And he's helping us.
Okay, Kevin. So, the whole book is helpful, but I really felt like, hey, actually the first chapter was the most important thing for me, because what I felt like he does, and again, he did it 14 years ago, is to get us into the conversation you and I were having last time that we felt like, hey, this is where the church is missing it a little bit. The whole idea of the question of what is the definition of racism. And he says, well, there are two answers that have been proposed, and let me frame them up for you. And again, he's very academically rigorous here. He's saying, let me show you these two definitions of racism that are generally being proposed and how they're different. Okay. And so in chapter one, it's just titled Two Views of Racism. And he basically says, here's the problem is that we're talking about racism, but there are two different ways of thinking about that. And people tend to not be clear on which of those definitions they're using in the conversation. And so things just get muddy. So he says the two dominant ways in which people in the United States define racism are the individualist definition and the structuralist definition. And if you listen to our conversation on critical race theory a few weeks ago, this will sound familiar, okay? Here's the individualist definition. The individualist definition of racism defines racism as something overt that can only be done by one individual to another. This philosophy assumes that individuals have the capacity to choose right from wrong and that sin is a result of our wrong choices. So he says, here's some examples. If an apartment manager decides not to rent an apartment to a black applicant, that manager is guilty of the sin of racism. If a teacher uses an insulting racial epithet against Hispanics, then the students will suffer from a racist action. If a personnel officer refuses to hire an Asian applicant, et cetera. So he's saying these are individual acts of racism, and that's what racism is. And what he says is, if the problem of racism is due to an individual action, then the solution to racism lies within the individual. And so if we can eliminate individuals, you know, being racist, then we can eradicate racism. So that's one definition. The structuralist definition, he says, believes that humans are affected by the social structures in which they live. And so racism is not merely individual actions, but it inheres in structural realities in society. Kevin, you want to give any more clarity to how he frames that out?
Well, I mean, this is really where we hit on last time, so maybe we won't go too much over it, but it is, and he fleshes this out more when he's talking about these four different perspectives. Some of them are appreciating the structural roots of racial inequality and racism more than others. And those that are, it's the idea that, even in a situation where maybe the individual level overt acts of discrimination are no longer acceptable or even legal, that the actual effects of historic racism that we can all agree is historic racism, whether it's segregation or whether it's slavery, segregation, Jim Crow, whatever it is, the effects of historic racism continue to exist in things like our tax structure,
right,
the educational system, the penal system,
So let me read a sentence. He says, according to the structuralist view, society can perpetuate racism even when individuals in the society mm-hmm. do not intend to be racist. Mm-hmm. That's a pretty clear way of describing what that view means. Now, here's what's intriguing. And again, remember, he's writing as a sociologist, and as Kevin will attest, sociologists, when they use statistics, they've done their homework, right? They don't make just vague generalizations. They're generally doing a good job drilling down into the details. Here's what Yancey notes about these two views. White evangelicals are even more individualistic than other whites, and Black evangelicals are even more structuralist than other Blacks. In other words, in their ideas about how to solve racial problems, white and Black evangelicals are even farther apart than whites and Blacks in mm-hmm. general. So this explains why the conversation in the church right now yeah. can feel really fraught, is because actually we're further apart within the church than even your average white person and your average Black person in society yeah. on how we think about these issues. So that's really interesting mm-hmm. because it explains a little bit of why I think this feels like a tense and challenging conversation in the Christian community, particularly.
Are you surprised by that finding?
I was. I would have not imagined that evangelicals would have been further apart on that, but that surprised mm-hmm. me.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think I have a good, fully thought out explanation, but I mean, just that emphasis in evangelicalism in modern American Christianity on personal salvation. And I think it just makes us very attuned to individual responsibility and makes it harder for us. But, you know, but that, I guess, me saying that would mean that that is a characteristic of white evangelicalism and not Black evangelicalism.
Well, and he even says white evangelicals have such a strong concept of personal sin. Right. Like, think about how we think about the gospel. It's like, you are a sinner and you need to personally be converted to faith in Jesus. Well, of course, we have a strong mm-hmm. doctrine of personal sin. And so he says, you know, if your average white person thinks people are kind of doing the best they can, and your average evangelical white person thinks that people are sinners who need salvation, you can see how there's going to be an overemphasis on the sort of personal responsibility side of things for most Christians. And that would maybe imply that in the Black community, there's just there's a stronger view of the corporate nature of sin. Like they have a better Old Testament, some of those passages we talked about in the last podcast, where there's just a sense of like, yeah, sin's not just an individual thing. It's something we participate in structurally. Mm-hmm. And so you can understand how our views of sin and how we think about what sin looks like in society probably play in here. Now, Yancey says both these definitions are true, have elements of truth in them. Both of them are incomplete because both of them ignore the spiritual dimensions of racism. So he says these are secular definitions. Neither definition speaks to the nature of humanity. So Christians should not be limited to thinking only about the spiritual dimensions of racism, but racism must ultimately be defined as a result of our human sin nature. So what he wants to say is there's elements of truth in both these definitions, but actually the answer is deeper than both. Mm-hmm. There's more we need to talk about here than just yeah. you're a bad person or structures are right. corrupt.
Yeah. Yeah. And then just adding the observation that these four different perspectives, which we still haven't defined and laid out, but we're going to, like, each of these is going to be pulling you towards one of those poles or the other, most likely. And so I think the challenge for a thoughtful biblical Christian is to be aware of those pullings and that might be, you know, inclining you towards thinking just in individualistic terms or structuralist terms, to be aware of that and how this particular, whatever it is, ideology or, you know, group of people that's speaking on a particular cause, how that is influencing you. And then to try to step back and say, okay, how do we apply a more balanced biblical perspective that appreciates both of these sides?
All right, so Kevin, let's survey these four models that he lays out in the first half of the book. Here they are: colorblindness, Anglo-conformity, multiculturalism, and white responsibility. So he says these are the four models that have been proposed for how we ought to deal with racism. Do you have enough clarity on summaries of these four that you just sort of want to tackle? All right, Kevin, tell us what these four are. Are you going to make me do that?
No, I don't care.
Go.
I think what he does is really helpful in the book. So if really one of the tasks of this podcast is to encourage people to pick up the book and read it, it'd be helpful for you to know that the way he lays this out is really helpful in each of these chapters, describing what is the perspective, like what are the claims that each of these secular perspectives on race relations is making? What are its strengths? Where does it seem to be incomplete or weak? How have Christians kind of adopted some of these concepts or ideas or ways of thinking in both productive and unproductive ways? And so it seems just a really kind of balanced tackling of each of these. So the first one, colorblindness is this first idea. And this is going to be somewhat familiar to most people, I think. They're basically, you know, this perspective would be making the claim that to end racism, we have to ignore racial reality. So we talked about this a little bit in the last podcast. So this is definitely what critical race theory is reacting against. They're saying that this is what the civil rights movement was kind of, they set us up to be in a colorblind society. But that's not enough. So the colorblind perspective would be, you know, let's not be race conscious. Let's subvert race issues in order to, you know, move on, I suppose.
Treat everyone as a human rather than a person of a particular race or ethnicity.
Yeah. And so they're assuming that racism has largely been, or Yancey's saying that this model assumes that racism has largely been defeated and that racial minorities have the same chance of success as the majority.
Cool. Anglo-conformity is maybe the one that most people will be least familiar with. And I was actually intrigued. That's the second model. And what he pointed out is that the Anglo-conformity model it is in a sense trying to take a nuanced approach and saying, actually, it's more than race. It's more about class.
Yeah.
And so this is the model that a lot of people were proposing in the 80s and 90s that said, hey, what we need is economic incentive and economic opportunity, because what we've done to blacks, not because they're black, but because of all the historic injustice, is we've prevented them from economic flourishing, and we've created a sort of a permanent underclass. And so if we just solve that problem, that will actually solve the problems of racism. So they sort of reduce racism to more of a classism, if you want to think of it that way.
Yeah. And so where it differs from the colorblind approach is that they are acknowledging, the Anglo-conformity model acknowledges the lasting effects of historic discrimination, but puts it in the camp of, okay, now overt discrimination of a racial type is less important for the outcomes for, say, African Americans than class-based discrimination and barriers to economic mobility. And yes, so the solution then for that is to the extent that we can elevate the economic standing of minority communities, the assumption is racial tensions would then decline if we can elevate their economic status.
And one of the good things there is he says, hey, these people often perceive answers that others overlook, that there are class and economic factors in play here. And so sometimes people that embrace this model will see things that sometimes we can overlook in our conversations about race.
Yeah, I think just helping listeners think about terms that they may have heard and how to map those onto these categories. So this is a pretty classic culture of poverty kind of argument.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The third model is multiculturalism, and this one is probably a little more familiar to most modern people because, you know, this is the idea of, hey, let's celebrate all perspectives, celebrate all cultures, celebrate, you know, let's rather than trying to conform people to one way of doing things, and rather than trying to avoid saying that there isn't any cultural, ethnic differences or racial differences, let's celebrate all of them.
Yeah. Yeah. And we see this, those of you who've been on a college campus in the last 20 years, 30 years know that, well, you know, have a African studies, you have Latino studies, you got all these things. These are an academic example or expression of multiculturalism. And yeah, this is certainly the thinking of about race relations that I think has been probably the most common in certain circles, especially in academic circles, for a long time. And so it should be pretty familiar.
He explains it this way: the colorblindness model envisions a society in which race is no longer a factor. Mm-hmm. The multiculturalist model envisions a society in which distinct racial and ethnic cultures are celebrated by all members of society.
Yeah. So multiculturalists would really push back against assimilation.
Right.
The idea that we're supposed to be an American melting pot. And they would offer a very different metaphor for what society should be, more like some sort of, you know, tapestry, I suppose. And where, and so their, you know, their critique is that Eurocentric white culture has been predominant and has repressed minority cultures in ways that are harmful. And so then their project then is, okay, how do we elevate minority cultures through all sorts of means, like those, you know, ethnic studies programs I mentioned.
And then the fourth model is white responsibility. And this is the one that's maybe most currently prominent. Right. This is the one that really comes out of critical race theory. In fact, he explicitly maps that in this chapter. And this paradigm would say it's white people's responsibility to take responsibility for racism, and that no minority can be racist. Mm-hmm. Only white people can be racist because racism is entirely structural.
Certainly takes that structuralist view of what the solutions would be and puts the responsibility squarely in the camp of majority culture. Yeah, so that definitely all the stuff that we talked about last podcast with critical race theory, that's, and you're right to say that it's important for listeners to see, okay, there's all these views out there that have had more vocal or more prominent expression at certain times. This is the one that we're talking about today. But don't forget, like, this is still one of a collection of different views, secular views of how to deal with race relations. It seems really in your face right now, but.
Well, and all four of these have their various proponents, but it's kind of interesting to think about decades. If you think about, like, the 80s was kind of the colorblind decade. The 90s was kind of more of an Anglo-conformity decade, the Clinton administration, especially in some of the economic incentives they were pursuing. The early 2000s was sort of the multiculturalism decade. And we're kind of now in the white responsibility.
That's interesting. Yeah, I hadn't thought about that.
It's kind of taken that journey. All right. So the interesting thing, you already mentioned this, but the interesting thing he does in each of these chapters is he says, hey, here's the strengths of this model and here's where it falls short. In naming where it falls short, he comes back to each one of these truncates or minimizes the reality of sin in some way.
Yeah.
What did you find most helpful about sort of how he framed that up?
Yeah. Here's where, so what I've been thinking about is, we need to have several things in mind when we're coming to this really complex issue. What he's advocating, what I agree with, is we need to have several things in mind as much as possible all the time. So groups that are involved, majority culture, majority members of the majority culture, members of the minority culture. Okay, so we need to be thinking about these different groups, but we need to be thinking about depravity applied to both groups, human depravity applied to both groups. But I think also, and he's not necessarily emphasizing this, but we need to be thinking at the same time about the image of God in both groups. So here we have like two groups of people and two really core fundamental Christian doctrines, human depravity, but then that we're still made in the image of God. If we were doing that work, which he's helping us, it helps to guard us against looking at a particular group as only good or only bad. And that's part of what he says is incomplete about many of these models. So for example, the multiculturalist model, it's celebrating the diversity of these cultures, but it's not willing to acknowledge that there perhaps is something deficient, or I don't want to use that term necessarily, but like there's something that doesn't conform to truth in some of these cultures. And we need some ability to be able to critique that because there's something, there's human sin.
He also points out, Kevin, that there's a tendency, like if you think about those majority minorities, so the temptation of the majority is always going to be to sort of ignore the responsibility or minimize the responsibility that we have. But he does a good job, and again, writing as an African American, to say, hey, the temptation to the minority here is to sort of overplay their hand as well. And to sort of, like he talks about in the multiculturalism model, it's common for it to celebrate everything except for European culture. Mm-hmm. And in the white responsibility model, it's common for that to look like, hey, it's actually only white culture that has sin that it needs to repent of, but not to look quite as clearly as at minority culture. So he seems to want to say, hey, in all of these, there's a temptation to sort of only place the blame or primarily place the blame in one category rather than asking all of us to do the work of repentance and faith.
Yeah. Yeah. I find his discussion of multiculturalism really helpful. Because there is a strength there. There is a strength and there is a limitation. I mean, we would be naive to think that we don't have a tendency to prioritize our own culture above others. And therefore, and there, in that, in some ways, that leads us to not see the truth, to not see people, to even not see the scriptures in ways that are fully faceted, you know, multifaceted, the way it's supposed to be interpreted. And so having different cultural perspectives on a situation, on a biblical text, on the church is really helpful. And so celebrating those things is great. But if that particular view is that every perspective, every culture is equally valid as every other one, except for at the same time, we're totally criticizing the majority culture while we're doing that. He says you kick the legs out from your ability to say something actually objectively true. So like at the same time, we're trying to celebrate the goodness of these cultures, but then we're saying that none of those actual differences actually matter. There's a problem there. There's an inconsistency. So we want to be able to celebrate how these different cultures add something to our understanding of the world and of God, et cetera, while still being able to say, okay, there's something called truth out there. And we want to hold to those things.
And to put different language on what you're saying and what he says, he doesn't use this language, but to go back to the two categories you used a minute ago, really what we're saying is in every culture, there's image of God that needs to be celebrated. And in every culture, there's human depravity that needs to be acknowledged. Mm-hmm. And those take shape differently, right? There's cultural sort of variance to sort of what those things look like, to how each cultural grouping is going to bear the image of God and to the ways that sin might play out within mm-hmm. that.
Yeah.
All right. So Bethany, Travis, I know you guys haven't read the book. Having just heard us talk about it, anything that strikes you?
It sounds really good. Sounds like it adds a lot of nuance to the conversation that I know I've been looking for of even just these four categories. I'm looking at this and like, wow, I really, really want to read this and hear more of what he has to say.
Yeah, I think the four categories are super helpful. And I'm also kind of what you had talked about at the beginning, struck by those two categories of evangelicals just being polar opposites, basically. That kind of like blew my mind a little bit, but I'm like, no, that makes sense. And that is what I see. And I think the tension that I'm feeling.
Yeah. So. And I think that point is calling the church to do something.
Yeah.
Like, listen, if we're further apart on this issue than the rest of the world, that's problematic on the surface, but we have more resources to bridge that gap. And therefore the bridging of that could be a really powerful witness.
Mm-hmm. Travis, what do you think of the cover art? I know listeners can't see it, but it's like a line of cars and there's like black hands reaching out of one window and white hands reaching out the other window. And then they're holding hands across this. It's kind of like,
I want to know if they just actually like, they actually set that up.
It looks like they posed this photo shoot. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. It's just kind of an odd cover image. But anyways, hey, we're going to come back and talk more about this in the next podcast. So this will be sort of a part one, part two. Obviously, what we've done so far is survey the first half of the book and sort of how he surveys these four proposed answers and the shortcomings of them. We're going to come back and talk about his solution and what we think is interesting about that. Again, the book is called Beyond Racial Gridlock: Embracing Mutual Responsibility, and we look forward to talking about it again in the next episode.
The goal of this podcast is to equip our own church for discipleship and mission. So if you're a Christian or a church leader in another context, we thank you for listening, and we pray that this conversation might be helpful to you as you minister in your context. We love to hear from listeners. So as Bob said, you can send us an email if you have feedback or if you have any other podcast topics that you'd like to hear us talk about. You can email us at podcast@cdomaha.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next Wednesday for another episode of the Wednesday Conversation.